Today on the Back Porch Education Podcast, the joys of research. What does it take to do research well? And what does it take to get students to do it well? Jason and Steve dig into this deep topic right now. Get your education.
Good morning, good afternoon. Steve, William Wordsworth today.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, I figure we'll just get right into it because I like this poem a lot. And as we're talking about the joys of research, I think this would be a helpful sounding board. So listen to this beautiful sonnet written by William Wordsworth entitled "Nuns fret not at their convent's narrow room." Nuns fret not at their convent's narrow room, and hermits are contented with their cells, and students with their pensive citadels. Maids at the wheel, the weaver at his loom, sit blithe and happy. Bees that soar for bloom, high as the highest peak of furnace fells, will murmur by the hour in foxglove bells. In truth, the prison into which we doom ourselves no prison is, and hence for me, in sundry moods, 'twas pastime to be bound within the sonnet's scanty plot of ground. Pleased if some souls, for such their needs must be, who have felt the weight of too much liberty, should find brief solace there, as I have found.
And students with their pensive citadels. I know some who do fret in there. Maybe they don't properly fit the term student. That's a great poem. Its central point is definitely true, not just of specifically research that we're talking about today, but of life, right? That the freedom to choose thereby puts us in a place of our choosing and thereby removes that feeling that it's constrictive, but rather where I've chosen to be, right? It's when we don't choose it that things get a little tight around the elbows, so to speak, get a little claustrophobic.
Right. Well, and sort of this notion of having when freedom is, well, liberty, right? When you have too much liberty, that is when it's wide open, that can be sort of arresting, right? Oh my goodness, I don't know what to do because I could do literally anything.
Yeah. Well, and in particular, right, so the topic of the joys of research, there seems to be at least a couple of things that bring about that joy. One is the desire, right?
I thought you were going to say MLA.
well, that's the other. You precede me here. The yearning to know, right?
Yes.
So if that's just not there, research is going to feel mundane because it's an exercise, really, ultimately in futility because I'm doing something I don't want to do, right? I'm not a nun and I'm stuck in a nun's closet, right. And I'm feeling I'm feeling the tightness of it. The other is the joy, I think, can come from well-framed research, right? Mm-hmm. That just casting myself out into the sea of knowledge doesn't bring joy. It brings frustration and confusion, and I just don't know where to start. So. Right. With my students, when we talk about, in particular, the art of writing to know that I'm going to set out to find something out that I want to know, the form, the scaffold, if I can use that term, that I erect to help guide that for the poet, as he's saying, it's the rules of the thing, right?
Right. The sonnet.
The sonnet has a certain number of lines and it has a rhyme scheme. And so, and the creative poet rejoices in that those rules, that mm-hmm. frames his then wide open field. Within this frame, what is there to know? Mm-hmm. And so I teach the research process formally to sophomores every year, and I tell them that really the skeleton of any good research is well-formed questions.
Yeah.
That I don't start with a key word, God bless their souls, right?
Sure.
Typed feverishly into the Google field.
Right.
But I sit and I think, this is the old canon of invention. And in research, what I'm inventing is the important questions. I can come up with a billion questions about some research topic, especially if it meets the first criteria of something I really want to know. Mm-hmm. I almost have too many questions, and so my job is discretion. What are the important questions? What order do the questions come in?
Right.
And I think that's a lot of the joy is setting out for myself an obtainable means by which to learn something I really want to know.
Yeah, that's huge. So when I taught first year comp at the university, I worked with other teaching assistants to develop a new curriculum. And one of the things that we decided to do was we have to teach this, right? Like this is an integral part of university life. And so you got to learn how to do this research process. And so we changed the way that we taught it a little bit in some pretty important ways. I think one of them, we tried to shy away from the word research and instead use the word inquiry, which perhaps is a minor change or superficial change, but it was helpful for getting students to realize that, I mean, when you say research, people think library. And when people think library, they think nothing is there that I want to know about, right?
You almost, it's like a stacking up of facts.
Right.
Yeah.
And whereas inquiry is this sort of, it's more expansive, at least as we taught it and envisioned it, right? There's more to it, right? When you're walking down the street and you look at something and you say, that's curious, that may well be the start of your inquiry process,
right?
The world's your oyster at that point, and nothing's off limits. Now, not everything's helpful, right?
Right.
What you ordered at McDonald's is not going to factor into your paper, probably, but it might. It really might, right? Where did this food come from?
That's one of the things that I think destroys joy for many students is they're at a lowest common denominator kind of thinking. As soon as I've cobbled together what I would call the beginnings of inquiry or research, mm-hmm. if they feel like they've got enough to write the paper, right? They're trying to get to the end. Teacher said,
right.
5 pages,
2000, right.
Yeah, whatever. So it's a mathematical problem to them. When it adds up, when I think I got enough stuff here to write a paper on, I stop. The joy of a really good inquiry is, and I see this especially in my seniors who are doing a thesis paper, not exactly. I mean, they're doing research. They're making inquiry into a question that they're trying to prove one side of. Right. Mm-hmm. So there is still investigation. They're still seeking evidence for their argument. And I have two kinds of students. I have those that'll show up to discuss it with me, and they've got, you know, bare minimum, bare bones. Look, you're going to have to do a lot more with this. This is just not right. enough. And they don't have the joy yet. But I'll regularly, I had the one fella turn in a rough draft of a 10 to 15 page thesis at 27 pages.
All right, which is a really nice place to be.
Right. The 15 pages is for my protection, right?
So right, exactly.
I don't have to evaluate and assess, you know, 20 or 30 page papers.
Right.
But I'm much happier to come back to that fella and say, look, this is awesome. It's just too much awesome. Mm-hmm. What's the most awesome parts
exactly.
and what can be for the purposes of this paper, what can be set aside for another day, mm-hmm. right? It's not, once you found it, it's not like you lose it.
right.
You've exceeded the limit rather than barely inching up to it, you know, mm-hmm. and it's just a whole different world to have to come in and be discerning and cast judgment on your findings to choose right. the best, the most appropriate to whatever your point is.
Right.
That correlates with the other thing about truly enjoyable research is at some point you just have to almost physically reach up and turn the spigot off. Mm-hmm. Right. My deadline's coming up. I can't keep going. I've got to stop and use what I found to write this paper because a deadline is upon me. Whereas in quote unquote real intellectual life, it never ends. One question leads right. to five more.
Right.
That each in turn birth their own children of the question. And it's, you know, it's sort of like Tolkien, right? With Middle Earth, he just keeps unfolding. His entire life. He right. just kept writing backwards and forwards,
right.
From that initial point. I don't even know what his initial, he probably would have been hard pressed to state when Middle Earth mm-hmm. came into existence, but it just kept becoming.
Right. Yeah. So one of my professors, gave me some advice that was incredibly helpful in getting one of my papers written because I just felt like there was too much. You know, I felt overwhelmed. I didn't feel like there was any way that I could do my topic justice. And so Dr. Schreier, shout out. Thank you, Dr. Schreier, for helping me write that paper on Cymbeline. The advice that he gave was don't think, write. Right. Like, don't stop thinking about it and just write. Now, that was exactly the advice that I needed to hear at that stage in my inquiry, at that stage in my research. But it's preceded by a huge gathering of ideas and theories and facts and data. Right. And so one of the things that basic like efficiency and economy teaches our students, much to their detriment, is you don't want to do any extra work, right? And what I hate to say to that kind of student, but once you learn it, I think it's true and will free you up quite a bit, is that research is an inefficient process, right? When yeah. you, what we want to do is grab a topic and then with laser beam focus, go grab exactly the facts that we need and slap them in the Word document, compile everything and turn it in. I have done that before, right? like it happens. But that wasn't a good paper. And it wasn't a good research process.
One of the grabbers of joy out of a process is time, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Either being given no deadline,
yeah.
where it stays sort of half-baked and move. There's nothing to motivate us to get real serious about it, versus what I all too often is, you know, rarely do I see a teacher assign something that demands research, you know, it's due tomorrow.
Right,
right. Sure. They almost always give you plenty of time. It's what you do with that time. Many students are so focused on the finished product. It's due on such and such a date. And unfortunately, they want your formula you were just discussing because it's now the night before. Mm-hmm. I haven't used the time given me wisely.
Right.
And so some of this is an issue of whatever you want to make a character or self-management or just we do live too busy of a life in most cases as students to really afford ourselves the time necessary to true intellectual life, because prep time, baking time, the time for invention, mm-hmm. just casting our thoughts out into the wide open.
Right.
When you limit that, yeah, the quality of the paper goes downward. I try to teach in whatever I'm talking about composition wise. The more thought and invention the more brainstorming, if you will, that goes in at the front end of it. If you do that first canon of invention well, the second one comes much easier. And the one we all focus on, the actual writing of the paper, is almost an afterthought. I don't mean that, but
right,
it feels much more like an afterthought, because if you cram all that, you still have the hardest part is coming up with what to say and then organizing it into a meaningful whole. And then the elocution, the expression of it still is waiting on those other two things to be done. But because you didn't give yourself enough time, it feels like it's one act.
Yep.
But it can't be. There's all three of those acts are still in play. So you haven't given yourself time to do it well.
Right.
Right. If you do that to yourself too many times, you start to feel, this is going to be another negative experience, because the real joy is in the hunt.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, it is.
And I've just gone out and shot the first rabbit I saw, because I got to get this thing cooked and in, right? The professor is sitting there tomorrow with knife and fork beating on the table. But if, I guess probably a triggering analogy at this point.
No, that's fine.
But the hunt is the fun, right? If I really want to know this, if there's joy to be found in this activity, it's going to be in the asking of questions and the seeking of those answers. And then in particular, what gets me going is that once you launch out into the field, all these new questions you hadn't even thought of.
Yes.
I'm now becoming bigger, right? I have new questions I had never thought of before. That's a joy-infusing activity to me.
That's right. And so, but it's so hard to, when you're on the clock, right, to be happy about those dead ends, right, that seemingly lead nowhere. But I would say that those are, when I really have the time, those dead ends are are some of the most fun, right? So, for instance, I had to do a comp paper, and so I did, and it was fine. But one of the things that I sort of picked up along the way was the dialect of Boontling. Okay, have you ever heard of Boontling, Steve?
No.
Okay, dude, it's amazing. Okay, so it is a dialect that was spoken in like Northern California about like two or three generations ago. And it was a way for the people of this small town to communicate and speak to one another like their own language. Okay.
So a town came up with its own.
Dude, it's so amazing. Okay. You'll have to check it out. Like, but basically what it does, it's largely, English, right? But it's like coded. It's incredibly heavy with, switching out words, right? So you might call, instead of calling, that animal a deer, you might call it an antler. Okay. Or a foreleg, okay? So that's one feature of it. The other feature is they cut the grammar to the bone, right? They leave out all sorts of words that we absolutely rely on for making meaning. The language is spoken in very short phrases that you would miss, right? And you wouldn't be able to, there wouldn't be those filler words that allow you to make sense of the sentence that someone's saying. Because they just say, I don't know, I can't even make it up because it's so different than sort of the way my brain works. Anyway, it's fascinating. And I was convinced that I was going to use this in my paper, but I ended up just not referencing it, right? The paper, as much as I loved learning about Boontling, it didn't work, right? It didn't actually fit in the paper. And so I had to just leave it aside. And that's fine. But now I know about this completely interesting thing, and it leads me down the path of what other sorts of languages or dialects are happening like this, and where else did this happen? Why did this happen? And, I have now this thing that I'm always looking for a place to put it, right? Like, I'm always sort of, no doubt in my life at some point there will be a paper where I go, oh, this is bootleg. Finally, I get to use it, right? So
yeah.
That was such a neat experience for me to be able to sit in that, to be able to inhabit their space for a while, to be able to try and see life through somebody who speaks Boont, like to live their life, you know?
Well, it's right. So if it is something that you've got some love for, right, the first requirement I set forth, then obviously the rabbit trails become almost a danger, you know, that I'll go off in one of them and never come back.
Right.
Or that this paper on X becomes a paper on Y. Like you said, you have to maintain the initial assignment, so to speak. My research paper in high school that was a big deal, the teacher, and I think this is important if we're talking to educators as we do on this podcast, the more latitude that you give the student to choose what they're researching, obviously that can go nuts. And you can get, you know, banal stuff, the research on the best kind of skateboard wheel or something. Even there, I don't know that that's illegit. Right. It might not fit what you're trying to do. Right.
Sure.
As a teacher. But you have to recognize that that's the nature of an assignment like a research paper is, in my opinion, to have as little as few of the rules of a sonnet as are possible to still produce a sonnet.
Right.
If that makes sense.
It does.
The teacher said, I hope you're going to spend a good portion of the, I think we spent a semester on this research paper. You know, spend some significant time on it. You know, choose something you want to know. So I took her advice of choosing something I really wanted to know to heart and actually made it something fairly practical. I paid my way through, paid my tuition for my Christian school that I was going to. By working in a restaurant and had worked my way into the kitchen and was fascinated by all things culinary. I was working with trained chefs. And so but I had no earthly idea what it would take to become a chef.
Okay.
So there's the question. What does it take to become a chef?
Yeah.
And I presented that to her as a possibility. She says, that's fine. It was a long rabbit hole because, what kind of chef do you want to be? And
right.
How formally do you wish to be trained? Do you wish to go down the sort of modern training, or do you want to go to classical training, perhaps over in France or blah, blah, blah? It just, I had no idea. But the direct result was, because it was something I really wanted to know, it did have the joy of bringing me to a decision. I don't want to be a chef. and it was because of these unknown things, such as the average person studying culinary arts gains 75 pounds in a 2-year course of study off the tip of their finger. You know, I looked at it and I said, I already probably weigh more than I ought to in high school. The last thing I want to do is send myself to an early grave.
Wow.
And there was a lot of research that exposed me to sort of the underbelly, right? The incredibly long hours, drink too much or do drugs or mess up their marriages or whatnot. And I just, as interesting as the job was to me when I did my research, one of the joys in this case was it steering me away from a potentially bad decision, right?
Right. Wow. So, I mean, how dare you, Steve, suggest that research has any practical outcomes? Right.
Well, if we want the process to be efficient, why can't the product produce something that's useful as well? And I don't want to jump off into a rabbit trail. That would be a terrible thing to do in a episode like this. But you and I have discussed the fact that there's writing that's, I would say, authentic or real or motivated from a place of I want to know. Mm-hmm. And then there's sort of the show writing, right?
Yes.
I'm going to do this because I think it'll get me in some journal or it'll get me a good grade with the teacher. When I'm not authentically asking the questions, I'm forming something that I think will sell.
Right.
That's good.
That's good.
Academic version of the pop song, right? The sellout, right?
Well,
I'm playing Frost one for the crowd.
Frost would say either building soil or taking something to market.
Yeah.
And okay, so good. Let's be super clear about that right here. That it's not that research is taking stuff to market, doing it for show, selling it off, and writing free form poetry is creative, right? Is authentic. It could just as easily be the case that those two are switched. People tend to think of research papers as the I'm just getting the grade, because often the research assignments and the papers that are produced from those assignments are quite boring, and they are for the purpose of getting a grade, right? But they don't have to be.
Well, they don't have to be, and it's not necessarily a sin if an occasional assignment is not trying to produce an immediate product, but rather trying to move a student along a formative path, mm-hmm. right? I know I've already mentioned this, but it's worth repeating. The strong emphasis on STEM these days. I occasionally have a student want me to join their side. There's too much math around here, right, Mr. Elliott? We should have more English, right, Mr. Elliott? And when are we ever going to really use math? And of course, all too often they have the teacher that says, "Well, when you need to balance your checkbook or some odd thing like that." but I'm like, you are so right. Because life doesn't have any problems that need solving. There's really no reason for you to study the solution to problems or the art of solving problems. This is stupid. You should be over here reading these books, right? And I'd say the same thing about why do we have to write a research paper? I'm never going to write a research paper outside of school. I don't know that that's defensible. I think that's a young mind not yet realizing what all they might be called upon to do in a workaday world mm-hmm. where research type documents are regularly generated for the boss who wants to know the information without doing the research himself.
Right.
But that's just keeping it practical, forming a soul that is inquisitive, right? This is what I like about your emphasis on inquiry, right? How do I know more about what I already know something of? How do I deepen myself? How do I broaden myself? How do I become bigger? There's a set of skills, dare we call them the liberal arts?
We might. We might be tempted.
That lead one towards a better life. Mm-hmm. And a part of that is seeking that which I don't know in order to live that better life. And so the state of wonder, of amazement, of inquiry, of well, what about, mm-hmm. is a mind frame that can be exercised, right? That's the basketball analogy. Why do I have to shoot all these free throws at practice? They don't count for anything. So that in the game, you make the game-winning free throws. That's why, or at least potentially, even if it ever comes about, the potential is in place because we've done what we were supposed to do in practice.
Readiness is all.
That's right. That is exactly right.
Is it Hamlet?
That says Hamlet. Yep, that's Hamlet.
Yeah, the readiness is all. Yeah, no, I agree that research or inquiry does have this formative element is incredibly important, right? That you want to be the kind of person who can research something well, right? Nobody's ever going to remove all their own blind spots, but acknowledging them and at least knowing where they are and knowing how you might go about reducing them is an incredibly important thing to learn about yourself, right? So it has even a sort of self-inspection element to it that I think can be tremendously helpful in personal growth. I think another sort of right alongside that when it comes to another sort of joy would be the ability that the attempt and just sort of the fun that comes along with joining the conversation that's going on around whatever topic you are working with, right? People think of like the ivory tower, that metaphor sticks for a reason. But it's through research that you are often able to sort of leave the ivory tower in a certain way, right? That you get to finally, it's not just you and your book anymore, but you finally, through your writing, get to join with others in the field and use and misuse and work with the ideas and thoughts and words of others. And that's a really freeing, really joyful part of it.
Yeah, but you catch their passion, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If they're deep into whatever it is that you're looking into, you get the bug from them. Mm-hmm. I have this story I tell regularly to students about this very thing of initially being forced into an area of study that I didn't see any benefit in and coming out a convert, right? I was taking a degree in Bible education. So I had to take all these classes on scripture. And once I got married, as anybody who's been a married student knows, it gets tighter, right? You got two people's schedules and mm-hmm. other issues. It gets more complex. So I was a part-time student trying to fit in all my requirements and in a setting in which a small college setting in which there wasn't a gazillion choices schedule wise.
Right.
And I realized that to get one of my credits or three of my credits in Bible, I was going to have very limited choices this semester of stuff that I hadn't yet taken that I needed or that were available to me for these sort of elective credits in my major.
Gotcha.
And every time, I remember playing with it a dozen different ways. The class that seemed to work just sounded awful.
Okay.
Biblical archaeology.
Oh.
I mean, like a puff of dust popped up in my face,
right.
Just looking at it in the catalog. And I'm like, no right. way.
Right.
And
right.
I saw a friend of mine and I said, do you know who teaches this course? And he said, it's Dr. Custer. And I said, oh, I've never had him. And part of my whole thing in seeking a degree in education was trying to have as many of the quote unquote better teaching professors as I could get into my schedule, because I used the class not only for the content of the course, but as an opportunity to see good teaching modeled. Right.
Yeah, sure.
And so I said, well, OK, I've heard a lot of great things about Dr. Custer. I've never had him. I'll take him.
Right.
I'm not thinking about what the content is. It's Dr. Custer's class. All right.
Right. Right.
And I get there first day and he walks in. And the dude blew up on us, not angrily, but with mm-hmm. passion.
Okay.
And got us into our Bible. And there was this reference to David rebuilding the walls of the city. And it used the reference in our King James Bibles that we were faithfully using. It used the term millo. And his last sentence of the class was, and that's why you need this class. And I mean, he had taken
sold. You're right. Yeah.
Bible students that wanted to know the scriptures. That's why we're majoring in it.
Right.
He's taken what he knows has got a bad rep and just sold it. I walked into my apartment that evening. My wife said, how was the class? I said, babe, we're dirt poor, but we've got to subscribe to the Biblical Archaeologist magazine. She said, what? And for 10 years, I was an ardent subscriber of that magazine.
Wow.
He infected me
yep.
with his lifelong love. You know, he had slides galore from his slides, not stuff he'd bought, right?
But right.
His travels. And he used to tell us going through customs was always hilarious because all he did in the Holy Land was walk around picking up broken pieces of pottery. He says, history's just laying around on the ground, students.
Yeah.
And he'd come back into the States with 10 pounds of broken pottery in his suitcase. It's wow. history. We must preserve it.
That's good. No, I think that serves as sort of a good a wrap up as any, right? In terms of let that be the model of research. Let that be what we think about when we think about uncovering problems and trying to figure out how to grow, right?
Yeah.
How to contribute, how to think.
Yeah, if the teacher assigning the project assigns it as an assignment, as something that's just got to be done, as something, a hurdle to be jumped over,
mm-hmm.
They're doing an injustice to their students, right?
Yes.
The assignment needs to carry the joy in it.
don't eat your vegetables.